I'm Maxine McHugh, and this is Talking Teaching.
Our school psychologists have just become part of a team. There's no stigma around it. It's just part of what makes us human.
Hello again. Today's podcast considers a compelling field of interest, that of positive psychology. There would not be too many schools in the country that don't have concerns about the psychological well-being of their students. Over and over, principals report that they feel they're dealing with almost an epidemic of stress, anxiety, even self-harm among young people. It's exercising a lot of minds. An emerging response is to flip the problem, to look at the ways that schools and communities can intervene early and actively teach strategies around well-being. That's what the all-boys school St. Peter's in Adelaide has been doing for over 7 years. Here's David Kolpak, one of two teachers in well-being, describing his approach at St. Peter's.
For a long time, boys were always told, you know, we didn't talk about emotions and we don't talk about our feelings. Didn't mean they weren't there. So what we have actually done, and we start these programs with our three-year-olds, so they learn degrees of emotion. You know, a boy might have said, I'm mad, or I'm sad, or I'm happy. But now they know degrees. What is mad? You know, am I just cranky? Have I got a little bit cranky this morning? Or am I enraged? You know, there's a huge variance between...
So they've got better at diagnosing their own feelings?
Exactly. And being able to articulate it. And being able to explain the reasons behind those feelings. So I'm having this feeling because this has happened. And even then predicting, if I go into the yard, this is how I'm feeling at the moment. I'm a bit scared that that level of, you know, that maybe not their words, but that feeling that I'm feeling at the moment might escalate and I might do something that's going to get me into trouble. So being able to learn self-regulation and acknowledge that these emotions are real, but not just that, but what do I have to do to manage those emotions? Because we say, you know, we grew up learning that anger was a wasted emotion. But we tell the boys now that anger is a real emotion. It's what you do with it. That it's okay to be mad. It's just not okay to disrespect someone or be mean to them.
So what have you noticed in terms of your students? Because as you know, we hear a huge amount these days from principals in schools across the sector about kids who are self-harming, kids who feel a huge sense of failure, who don't know how to self-regulate. So are you seeing differences given how long you've been doing this?
The behaviours may not disappear, but the difference is a boy recognises that he may be at risk. So the boys will come and say, I have just been to the toilets and I've done this. Or I'm feeling like this and I'm worried that if I leave the school grounds, I might do this. So to be able to acknowledge it and then seek help. To our families, I call it a toolkit. What we're giving is a toolkit. And we learn that there are different times where we need different tools and not every tool fits every purpose. But to know that this tool is something I can use and hope for the best. Our school psychologists have just become part of a team. We have boys that will say, I need to see, and they'll ask to see one of the psychologists. There's no stigma around it. So to me, the whole growth of the program has just said, Our mental well-being, and we talk to the boys about the difference between well-being and ill-being. We don't use the whole well-being over the one spectrum. Is no different from seeing somebody if we have a sore knee or if we have an upset tummy. Our brain is something or our heart is something that we might need to talk to somebody about how we're feeling. What are we processing in our mind? It's just part of what makes us human.
You must hear some incredible stories, though. What do you think is driving so much anxiety among young people?
I think social media is a really easy one to blame. There are elements of it, but there are also elements of, I think, busyness of life. I think media in itself portrays an image that our children may think is unattainable, that level of perfectionism. So, you know, growing up, if I took a photo of someone, I took one photo, I had to wait 2 weeks to get it developed and it came back. You know, we might take 50 photos till we get the photo that we think is perfect or near to being perfect. We'll use that. But no one knows that it's taken 50 other photos to get there. we see an image that portrays perfection or portrays perhaps something that's not real. Because, we don't know what's going on behind the eyes of the person in the photo. We have lost the art of boredom. Growing up, I remember my parents saying to me, oh, boredom's a state of mind. Go and find something to do. Well, no one's bored anymore because they're all picking up a device.
They're all hyper-stimulated.
Exactly. It's the opposite.
And expect to be.
That's right. And as an adult, and if we can't find something, so if I pick up my phone and I can't find something after three swipes or three clicks, I've probably forgotten and moved on to the next.
David Kolpak was one of hundreds of national and international speakers who came together in Melbourne recently for the 6th World Congress on Positive Psychology. It's the first time this event has been held outside of the United States. The event partner was the University of Melbourne's Centre for Positive Psychology, located in the Graduate School of Education. Now, the centre is rapidly developing a global reputation for its research and its wellbeing programs and partnerships. Just ahead of the start of the conference, I spoke with Director Professor Lindsay Oades and asked him first to explain what we mean by well-being.
Well-being, it can mean many things, but to psychologists, we obviously take a psychological approach to it. So how do our thoughts, emotions, behaviours all come together to create either a sense of well-being? And well-being, there are big debates about what well-being is. Some of us can think of it more as pleasure and positive emotions, which gets called the hedonic approach. Other people like to think of well-being as being a broader concept that includes our meaning, our purpose, our values, and the sense of living a good life and being satisfied with the life we're living, which is a different concept than health by itself. And often it's a more of a subjective sense of, is this life good? Am I feeling good? Am I doing well? Am I functioning well?
So what are the components that generally need to be in place for an individual to feel they have a sense of well-being?
There are different views on that, but just to take some of the very common views, and I'll start with the one I think is a big and a very reliable view, and that's a sense of connectedness, sense of positive relationships. We are social beings, and so the quality of our relationships, both individual, interpersonal, intimate relationships, or broader sense of connections, that's a big one. And I remember I originally trained as a clinical psychologist. I remember the ward rounds we did in the acute hospitals, psychiatric hospitals. Time after time, this 17 or 18-year-old male, he's been admitted with a psychotic episode to a mental hospital because he's had a relationship breakup. So I've seen many, many times the strength and importance of relationships and relationship quality as one of the big ones.
So connection is one. What would be next?
The other one is just emotions themselves. So the sense of positive emotions. Do we have more positive emotions than negative emotions, or do we have more pleasure than pain? So that matters because it's almost like an energy that keeps us going, keeps us sustained. But a lot of the debates will say, no, that doesn't capture all of well-being. It captures happiness. But it's not the whole deal. So to summarise that, I'd say positive emotions, or that sense of feeling good.
What about the need to have, say, some kind of purpose in life, a reason to get out of bed in the morning?
So the other part is purpose, and that often travels with meaning. So the idea of purpose and meaning, a meaningful life. Professor Mike Steger is actually presenting tonight exactly on that topic. So one of the discussions in wellbeing science is how much is it about wellbeing and happiness, and how much is it really simply about meaning? So meaning itself can mean several different things. It can actually say my life has a sense of meaning, but also I'm contributing to something bigger than myself. So that sense of purpose for my own life, but also how am I contributing to others and for others? We see that developmentally. You often see as people age, that becomes increasingly important about what's the meaning of my life and what am I contributing and what legacy am I leaving as well. So that's another big part of the psychological factors of well-being. Probably I'll add another one while I'm going. Sense of meaningful activity or sense of engagement or purpose. Am I keeping busy? Am I doing something which is meaningful, or am I engaged? One way of thinking about engaged, other than work, is also hobbies. What do I get absorbed in? What keeps me energized? And that can vary from gardening, gaming. There are many different ways we do that. But does something capture me? Do I engage in something?
What about contentment? Because, I mean, that's a bit of a
bit of a daggy word in some ways, but how important is this notion of, you know, I'm just content, not necessarily deliriously happy, but content?
You hear contentment, some people say, they'll think of the Eastern traditions, which really champion what we would call low arousal emotions or low arousal states. So it's, I'm calm, I'm content, I'm complete in myself, or I'm satisfied, or I don't have any burning needs. And a lot of the Eastern traditions champion that as the optimal state, whereas part of the Western traditions, and particularly, say, American psychology, joy, high arousal, happy is seen as the valid state, which is slightly different than contentment. So you will see some big cultural differences in how we understand contentment, but you also see individual differences. Some people will actually think of happiness and well-being as content, I'm okay, leave me alone, whereas other, say particularly extroverts, they'll see happiness as a sort of more high activated state, and I've got to be moving and doing things and having joy and having lots of positive emotions.
What you're describing, Lindsay, sounds to me like something that an emotionally mature individual might certainly get to at some point in their life. But for a lot of young people, I imagine they're really struggling with this because they're probably chasing the next pleasure fix and all the rest of it. Does this explain why so many young people are either stressed, anxious, at the worst, they're self-harming? What's going on with this emerging generation?
That's a really important question. If we look at, you know, if you take a day-to-day life of a young person, and I struggle with this with myself as a parent of two teenagers, and my son walks to school with looking at his phone, and as we know here in Victoria, there is a debate about whether phones should be allowed in school. So with the rise of technology and mobile devices, that's only part of what's going on in modern young people's lives.
But do you think that is adding to
absolutely
what
adding,
we're seeing?
And fragmentation of attention, I think, is a big part of it.
Is it also the idea that because you're connected to a whole bunch of friends who might have liked you on Facebook, that is the same kind of connection you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, when in fact we know it's not?
I think it has that type of connection still can have its advantages if it's well managed. And my colleague, Associate Professor Peggy Kern, actually does some of the social media related research on that type of work. But at the same time, the fragmentation it can create to your attention, so you don't get that rested, content state because you're distracted by the new like or the new buzz. And so that sustained and focused attention, which of course is the opposite of things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So can we pay attention? How long can we pay attention for? And also, obviously, we're hearing a lot more about mindfulness and meditation. If that's done well, that is attentional regulation. That's how to regulate your attention, not just pay attention, but how to regulate how you pay attention, which is a skill we can all benefit from. And there are simple ways of doing that, like nothing new, watch your breath, breathing exercises. All of these types of skills are good for everyone all of the time. And they have benefits such as being able to pay attention, being able to notice and regulate your emotions and your anxiety. I notice myself as I get older, I don't like getting on planes as much as I used to. I feel a bit claustrophobic, but I also know how very quickly to look at my thoughts and do breathing exercises. Those types of skills, if we can equip a whole generation of young people with them, that's what I'll call wellbeing is everyone's business. It's that distribution of responsibility so they learn skills and capabilities, they being students, young people, rather than we need more services, and referring everyone off for specialist services. It's actually equipping the whole population through the school system in time with that broader skill sets. Some of it's common sense, some of it's not, but the challenge in my view is how do we do it at scale?
We know that one of the best predictors of individual well-being is the quality of relationships. So what is it that schools can do, do you think, to help foster richer relationships?
Answer that in a few ways. There's several relationships going on there. There's the teacher-student relationship, there's the peer-to-peer relationship, and then there's the child or student-to-parent relationship. And as we know, developmentally, of course, that changes, and the peer-to-peer relationship becomes much more important in the secondary school than it is in the primary. So, for example, some of the work we're doing, my colleague Professor Diane Vella Broderick actually has a project where they do peer-to-peer mentoring, and so they're actually equipping They're equipping the young people in how to mentor or coach each other. So rather than teacher for student, the teachers are equipping the young people in how to mentor each other. So that's the type of example of emphasising the role and leveraging the role of the peer to deliver, you know, or talk about whatever needs to be.
And what are the early indicators of how that's working?
The early indicators are that it's extremely well received, and they enjoy working with both their peers, but they also enjoy the fact that they're being equipped with a new skill. And this is in a transitions project, which is helping young people transition out of secondary school either to work or further study. So the early indicators are that it's really well received, and they are learning things that they, as in from a research perspective, they're learning things that they might not otherwise learn because of the open language which is occurring between the age peers.
So if schools are to, if you like, embed this notion of well-being, what's that going to look like, Lindsay?
Multiple factors. So firstly, there's the curriculum factors. So is it in the curriculum? So it isn't just
An add-on.
It isn't just referring. When I say just, it is more than, because the things I'm talking about are important. So it's more than counselling services. It's more than a subject or an occasional unit. It's actually looking at the curriculum. And does the curriculum serve the development of wellbeing, knowledge, capability and skills? And part of both the federal and state curriculums, they do have aspects of this in them. But as you well know, teachers are very busy. The curriculums are very contested, full space. I think one of the magic parts is pedagogy. Teachers are skilled professionals. They're creative, enabling teachers to actually build wellbeing enhancing things into their pedagogy. And they do that in part, but different teachers will receive that differently. Then I'd come to the school community. So the idea of whole of school or whole of community approaches to wellbeing, which of course is something we're seeing in a project we have out at Maroondah City Council in Victoria in Australia, a cluster of, well, it was 21, it's now 27 schools who are implementing positive education. So what that means is teachers, students and parents being trained in things related to how to develop your wellbeing, positive education. So they're learning about things like strengths, mindfulness, how to self-regulate, optimism, and what I would call wellbeing literacy. They're learning the language of wellbeing. So not just what it is, but how to communicate it about it, which is something I'm personally very interested in our research program on wellbeing literacy. So not only do I know something, but I have the capability to communicate about it, which is really important. If you look at some of our initiatives we have, Are You Okay Day, a lot of them are communication capabilities. It's can we actually not just express our feelings, but talk about life, meaning, purpose, most of the things we care about, and can we actually communicate about them effectively?
Now, if we get this right, does this approach have the capacity to really try and stem, if not reverse, some of these awful statistics we see? You know, so many Australians now with mental illness, a very high rate of youth suicide. Can we start to see some change in these awful statistics?
My simple answer to that is we tend to be seeing the same statistics or in some ways worse, but I often hear, if you turn on the television, you hear the statistics and then you hear the phrase, we need more services. And what that usually means is we need more medical services. I think medical services are wonderful. However, they're one part of a solution to a much bigger system.
So in fact, there's too much of a default position to, if you like, a drug-based solution?
Yeah, it's a default. It's default to a medical drug-based solution, so that what I would call the medicalisation of distress, and it's certainly there. And don't get me wrong, because this can be misinterpreted, these services are definitely needed. Medical professionals are doing great things, but that's for a particular part of the population at a particular stage in where things might have gone wrong. I'm saying much earlier, and I mean much earlier, as in early childhood, are we equipping young people with these skills, wellbeing literacy, these broader skills about how to communicate about and for wellbeing, and that's deliberately very general because it encapsulates a lot of things. And is that seen as a legitimate part of curriculum pedagogy and making wellbeing everyone's business? Because we equip a population with those skills from the outset and not rely and not blame medical services. Medical services cannot be responsible for the population of the whole society or community, nor should they be. But negativity bias, if we talk about suicide, we immediately think of distress, illness, then we go to symptoms and medical, and then we start to build systems and narratives. The way we even talk about this becomes the default. And wellbeing sits above education, medicine. It's a broader, it's part of our lived experience.
I think you've got a nice phrase about this, which is teach rather than treat.
Yeah, teach rather than treat. And it's not don't treat, it's teach rather than treat.
Nonetheless, would I be right in thinking there's certain tension then between, if you like, the psychologists and the psychiatrists in this area?
There is a tension. However, a lot of psychology and clinical psychology has unwittingly taken a fairly individual deficit-based approach, which is exactly what positive psychology is trying to question or not remove, but add another option or add more than. So I often take this back to my own child. My son's about to turn 13. If I was to ask him what he wants out of his life, or if you were asked to me what I want for him, I wouldn't say I don't want him to have mental illness. I might say that, but that's not what I would hope for. That's not what his life or what we're trying to grow our young children into. If you have a mental illness, yeah, you definitely don't want to have a mental illness, but it's not the starting point of how we should be thinking about our young people. We want capable, flexible, happy young people, and if they have to not have mental illness or treat mental illness to get that, we do it. But it shouldn't be the overarching narrative of how we position how we think about wellbeing, mental health for young people. This is why I take a capability approach. What can our young people be and do? And if they are capable, they're less likely to have mental illness. But we need to shift our discourse, well, I'd say upstairs, and see the medical thing as only part of what we're doing. So if we take, again, Victoria in Australia, in Melbourne, there's discussion of putting GPs in every school, in every state school, which I think is a good thing. But at the same time, I'm worried that that will further medicalise how we talk about wellbeing and our lived experience. If young people are learning new words, and those words are all deficit-based, if they're learning anxiety, depression, suicide, they're learning all this language.
And we pathologise yet another issue.
That's right, and that's how they interpret their experience.
Let's come back to the education side of this. Here we are, Melbourne Graduate School of Education. To what extent now is this being embedded in initial teacher training?
I would say not enough yet, but it is coming, and there is a significant demand and interest from teachers in how to do this. It's being embedded in teacher training more than it was, but there's still a way to go for the very same reason I mentioned before, the crowded curriculum. Teachers are held accountable to teach lots of things.
But if you think about it, I mean, if they are incorporating this in their practice, it's going to actually not make their job easier, but certainly there may not be the problems down the track.
That's the hope. And teachers are asking for it. You know, as you become a more experienced and skilled teacher, and you're able to manage a classroom, but you start to realise that your role is, you know, traditionally we would have called it pastoral. Now I would say heavily student wellbeing focused. And if we start to understand the relationship between student wellbeing and academic performance, teachers really start to realise how important this is.
What's the evidence show us on that, by the way?
Without going into too much detail, there is evidence that, you know, if you're functioning better, by definition, you'll also perform better academically. However, it can tip, as in if you're too focused on your academics, you can, you know, perfectionism, anxiety. But there is a relationship. So one of the things I do deliberately is I talk about wellbeing and performance rather than wellbeing or performance, because some people try and think, oh, well, you can either perform really well academically or you can be really happy and have a good time. Actually, you can do and should do both. And the evidence is that, you know, wellbeing involves good functioning, therefore it involves good academic functioning.
That's it for another Talking Teaching. This has been a production of the University of Melbourne and recorded at the Horwood Studios. Our sound engineer is Gavin Naber, who's also composed the theme music you hear at the start and conclusion of this podcast. Bye for now.